Greetings to all of you. It's wonderful to see you today. It's an exciting time of year, and I hope you all have the feast fever. Elsie and I were up in Northwest Arkansas for the Feast of Trumpets and for the day after, the Sabbath just before the Feast of Trumpets, and that was very inspiring as well. Wasn't that awesome to hear about the prayers going out for the fires around Camp High Sierra? And then right after the prayer request was sent out, they had 2 days of rain. That was such an awesome thing. We certainly are going to miss Randall and Liz and Ryan and Anjanae Bradford. We wish them the best, and God bless them and Godspeed for them. And we hope that all of you have a wonderful Feast of Tabernacles and trip. And God be with you and bless you in all of that. God has a plan to expand His family by making many sons of God, many sons and daughters of God. So my question is, why has God had such a hands-off policy for 6,000 years, granting human beings such amazing independence? Well, maybe there are several reasons, but ever since I've been in the church, we have felt that one of the reasons is to give human beings the opportunity to see if they could solve their problems by themselves and to bring lasting peace and prosperity to the world, to bring about peace on earth and goodwill among men, to bring about the brotherhood of man and world peace. And God knew that human beings would have enough pride and foolishness to think that they could do it, to get the idea in their naivete and wishful thinking that somehow they, with their good intentions, could bring about great peace and prosperity to the world through some kind of a one-world government, perhaps. And so because of that naive hope of human beings, they have been suckered into following many charismatic leaders who promised them great things, and usually once they gained the following, the leader would become a tyrant. They would actually take away their freedom and the blessings that they had had. Oh, leaders have promised great things, promised near paradise. Well, God has not only allowed human beings this opportunity, but in order to give them a little assistance in trying various experiments, God has given from time to time special opportunities to human beings so that they would have a certain advantage and think, well, wow, with this advantage, we can really accomplish great things. So God has given some very interesting situations and opportunities to human beings, and I'm going to cover those today. The title of this sermon is Past Opportunities for Paradise. Past opportunities for paradise. The first situation is to give human beings a physical paradise with a nature, a human nature that is was actually better than the human nature later on, and to give them such abundance to be surrounded with plenty of wonderful things to eat, a perfect climate, perfect conditions, and to see if that head start, that huge advantage, all those physical advantages, would enable them to just establish God's way of life and have children and spread this ideal way of life around the world. Well, that was Adam and Eve, but that experiment did not last very long. They did not bring about paradise. In fact, there was troubles very soon in their own family. And because of the disobedience to God, they experienced what most people call the fall of Adam and Eve. And I don't think we understand that very well as to what happened. And I'm going to be very interested to learn when Christ comes back exactly what happened in the mind of Adam and Eve. They were not perfect before they disobeyed God and gave in to the temptation that the serpent offered them. If they had been perfect, they would have obeyed God and not eaten the forbidden fruit to begin with. So something was wrong. They were willing to be disobedient. Actually, the Bible tells us that she was deceived. Eve was deceived, but then Adam went along with it, and he knew better, and he went ahead and ate it anyway. So they were not perfect, but it got worse. I mean, they had weaknesses, but after they disobeyed God, they felt the shame and so forth, and they went and hid from God. So obviously things were much worse after that. So that opportunity for paradise did not last very long. That opportunity failed. Now the next situation is based on the fact that many people have realized that one of the problems in human civilization is that by the time a person has matured enough and gained knowledge and education and wisdom and has become very efficient and productive in his life, he gets old and he dies. So people don't last very long. And it's almost like we're reinventing the wheel. You know, people, we have to start over again with the next generation trying to gain wisdom and so forth. And because of the short lifespans, there's not a lot of overlapping. So what God did is for the first 1,500 years, he gave these huge lifespans to people. Now that means by the time you, let's say, are 100 years old, you have some wisdom and education and experience, you should be able to do great, wonderful things. Plus the fact that the generations were greatly overlapping. In other words, in one generation, they could see their children and their grandchildren and their great-grandchildren and maybe great-great-grandchildren. And so that's an advantage too, because you can communicate with the next generations and you can go back to previous generations and talk to those people and learn from them as your mentors and so forth. So that should have been a huge advantage. The earth was a wonderful place, and God had revealed a certain amount of truth to Adam and Eve that could be passed on down. And there were a few righteous people. Because of the fact that there were a few righteous people shows that right knowledge was available. But that absolutely failed. Genesis 6 tells us that the whole world was filled with wickedness. And it was so terribly wicked that God decided to destroy all humanity. And it was basically because of the righteousness of just one man, Noah. We don't know how righteous his wife and his children were, and his daughters-in-law. They were, at least they were going along with Noah. We don't know how much they understood and how much they were converted like Noah was. But at least they were cooperative. And so God saved Noah and his wife and the sons and their wives. But that advantage in having very, very long lives did not bring paradise, even though that was a huge advantage. Now, the next time that I want to focus on is when God decided now is the time to start my own nation, where I am going to pick a people and give them liberty and all kinds of benefits and blessings, and I will personally preside over them as their king and their priest and their God, and I can speak to their leader Moses, and I can direct them from day to day and protect them and bless them in all kinds of ways. So God chose the people that were in captivity in Egypt. He performed all kinds of miracles to help them to see the power and the love of God, and brought them out of there and led them on the way to the promised land. Now, he gave them huge advantages, and I'm going to turn to a couple of places. Exodus 23 to begin with, and show you as a reminder of the awesome opportunities they had. Now, we know that the reason God chose them was not only to demonstrate his power and love, but to also to give them the opportunity to be the example nation to the world, to be the role model that would help others to learn God's ways and how that would bring about wonderful blessings. And that was the calling that they had. Now, Exodus 23 and verse 20, he says, "Behold, I send an angel before you to keep you in the way and to bring you into the place which I have prepared." So that angel is capitalized appropriately because that was the word that became Jesus Christ. Now skip on down to verse 25. "So you shall serve the Eternal your God, and he will bless your bread and your water, and I will take sickness away from the midst of you, and no one shall suffer miscarriage or be barren in your land. I will fulfill the number of your days. I will send my fear before you. I will cause confusion among all the people to whom you come, and I will make all your enemies turn their backs to you. I will send hornets before you, which shall drive out the Hivite, the Canaanite, and the Hittite before you." So there are just some of the awesome things that God promised to do for them. Now for some more, let's turn to Deuteronomy 6. Deuteronomy 6 and verse 3 to begin with. He says, "Therefore hear, O Israel, and be careful to observe it, that it may be well with you, and that you may multiply greatly, as the Eternal God of your fathers has promised you, a land flowing with milk and honey." I love the taste of honey and milk together, but the idea is that this would be a place where it would be ideal for cattle, for sheep and goats and cattle. There would be plenty of grass and so forth, and also plenty of flowers for the bees to make honey. In other words, a very lush, productive, blessed land that God would give them. And so going down to verse 10, "So it shall be when the Eternal your God brings you into the land of which I swore to your fathers, to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, to give you large and beautiful cities which you did not build, houses full of good things which you did not fill, hewn out wells which you did not dig, vineyards and olive trees which you did not plant." And then he says, "When you have eaten and are full, then beware lest you forget the Eternal who brought you out of the land of Egypt from the house of bondage." They could not use the excuse that, well, we had it hard. We were struggling to survive. We were struggling just to have food on the table and to find a place to live and dig wells. They had so many advantages to make life so easy. And here God had been teaching them through Moses and others, teaching them all about God's laws, about the Ten Commandments, and how that they could be blessed spiritually, mentally, physically, in every way. And they had all these physical advantages. It was almost like a paradise, a physical paradise, going into this land of milk and honey. But it didn't last very long, did it? They did not bring about paradise. And the key to that, perhaps the most significant key to summarize what their problem was, is over here in Deuteronomy 29. Deuteronomy 29, beginning in verse 3, he says, "You've seen the great trials which your eyes have seen, the signs and those great wonders. Yet the Eternal has not given you a heart to perceive and eyes to see and ears to hear to this very day." He means that God did not give the spiritual eyes and ears to understand spiritually. Yeah, they had the knowledge revealed to them of God's laws and way of life, but they were not converted. They did not have the heart, and they certainly did not bring about paradise. In fact, when you begin to read the book of Judges, things went downhill very fast. They kept turning away from God and turning away from His laws. God had to keep punishing them. And they would seem to learn their lesson and be repentant, and God would bring them back out of captivity. And then before long, they were going back into idolatry and all kinds of problems. So that great experiment did not bring about paradise. Now the next period I'd like to focus on is the period of David and Solomon. Now David did not have a lot of peace during his 40-year reign. In fact, he was fighting battles and gaining territory and subduing enemies. So his reign sort of prepared the way for the reign of his son Solomon. So by the time that David died and Solomon took the throne, there was peace and prosperity, and then that continued on throughout the reign of Solomon. So here God was giving Solomon great wisdom, great power, great peace, and phenomenal wealth. Now that should have been a huge advantage. Here they had the truth of God. They had a relationship with God. They had the temple of God. They had the priesthood of God. They knew the truth of God. But let's go to 2 Chronicles 9. 2 Chronicles 9. And it's a phenomenal what the conditions were. 2 Chronicles 9, beginning in verse 1. Now, when the queen of Sheba heard of the fame of Solomon, she came to Jerusalem to test Solomon with hard questions, having a very great retinue, camels that bore spices, gold in abundance, and precious stones. And when she came to Solomon, she spoke with him about all that was in her heart. So Solomon answered all her questions. There was nothing so difficult for Solomon that he could not explain it to her. And when the queen of Sheba had seen the wisdom of Solomon, the house that he had built, the food on his table, the seating of his servants, the service of his waiters and their apparel, his cupbearers and their apparel, and his entryway by which he went up to the house of the Eternal, there was no more spirit in her. It's like she was overwhelmed. It's like it took her breath away. Verse 5, then she said to the king, "It was a true report which I heard in my own land about your words and your wisdom. However, I did not believe their words until I came and saw with my own eyes. And indeed, the half of the greatness of your wisdom was not told me. You exceed the fame of which I heard. Happy are your men, and happy are these your servants who stand continuously before you and hear your wisdom. Blessed be the Eternal your God, who delighted in you, setting you on his throne to be king for the Eternal your God. Because your God has loved Israel to establish them forever, therefore he made you king over them to do justice and righteousness." Wow. Talking about advantages, to have a king like that and to have such awesome conditions. Let's look also beginning in verse 20. Verse 20. All King Solomon's drinking vessels were gold, and all the vessels of the house of the forest of Lebanon were pure gold. Not one was silver, for silver was accounted as nothing in the days of Solomon. But the king's ships went to Tarshish with the servants of Hiram. Once every 3 years the merchant ships came, bringing gold, silver, ivory, apes, and monkeys. So King Solomon surpassed all the kings of the earth in riches and wisdom. And all the kings of the earth sought the presence of Solomon to hear his wisdom, which God had put in his heart. So Solomon really had the bully pulpit. He had the opportunity to influence all the kings and leaders of the earth because they looked up to him so much, and they respected him and feared him also because he and Israel had such great power that no one dared challenge him or even think about rebelling. So there was this great peace, worldwide peace, during that time. Verse 26 says, "So Solomon reigned over all the kings from the river, the Euphrates River, to the land of the Philistines, as far as the border of Egypt." What an awesome time. However, we could turn over to 1 Kings 11, which I won't do, but that describes what happened. Solomon loved many wives and concubines, and they turned his heart away from God. So here he was so wise, but he did what was so foolish, to marry all these women, and especially women who were idolatrous and pagan. And it's very hard not to be influenced by someone you are married to. And sure enough, God had warned him not to do that, but he did it anyway. So this kind of a semi-paradise came to an end. That did not bring about paradise after all. In fact, after Solomon died, you know, the kingdom was split up, and troubles after that. The next situation I want to describe is where you have another world ruler who has such power over the civilized world and even over the animals and birds. Now, we tend to think of that as something that is only going to happen in the millennium. And I imagine what is going to happen during the millennium is going to be even more dramatic, because it seems like even all the predators, all the carnivorous meat-eating animals, are no longer going to be trying to kill other animals. But there's something similar, a parallel, that happened even during the reign of, and I guess I haven't said his name, you might have guessed by now, Nebuchadnezzar. That was an awesome experiment where God gave him phenomenal power and opportunities. Babylon became such an awesome city, became famous all over the world. Supposedly, the Hanging Gardens of Babylon were one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. He built awesome temples and a great bridge over the Euphrates River. But now I want to turn to Jeremiah 25. We're going to look at several scriptures to show in what special way God was dealing with Nebuchadnezzar. Jeremiah 25, and Jeremiah is speaking here, and he's telling them, because the Israelites have, the Jews and the people of Judah have been rebelling, telling them that Nebuchadnezzar specifically was the leader who was going to conquer them. So verse 8, Jeremiah 25 and verse 8, "Therefore says the Eternal of hosts, because you have not heard my words, behold, I will send and take all the families of the north, says the Eternal, and Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, my servant." How interesting. God is calling Nebuchadnezzar my servant. "And will bring them against this land, against its inhabitants, and against these nations all around, and will utterly destroy them and make them an astonishment, a hissing, and perpetual desolations." And then going down to verse 11, "And this whole land shall be a desolation and an astonishment, and these nations shall serve the king of Babylon 70 years. So these prophecies were very specific. Now look at chapter 27 and verse 6. "And now I have given all these lands into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, my servant, and the beasts of the field I have also given him to serve him." Not only would what were considered wild animals be not dangerous, but it says the animals will serve him, I guess in whatever way he wanted to use them. And then verse 8, "And it shall be that the nation and kingdom which will not serve Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, and which will not put its neck under the yoke of the king of Babylon, that nation I will punish, says the Eternal, with the sword, the famine, the pestilence, until I have consumed them by his hand." It's like he's saying, if you don't submit to Nebuchadnezzar, then I am going to punish you. Now chapter 28 and verse 14. "For thus says the Eternal of hosts, the God of Israel, I have put a yoke of iron on the neck of all these nations, that they may serve Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, and they shall serve him. I have given him the beast of the field also." This is one of the most surprising things in the Bible to me, is how God did this for a while at this very special time. And now let's turn to the book of Daniel, Daniel 2. Daniel 2 is telling about this dream that Nebuchadnezzar had, and Daniel came in to give the interpretation of the dream. And it's interesting that I think this is written from the standpoint of Nebuchadnezzar. And so it's like he's one of the authors of the Bible. But Daniel 2, beginning in verse 36. Now Daniel's telling the dream. This is the dream. Now we will tell the interpretation of it before the king. You, O king, are a king of kings. For the God of heaven has given you a kingdom, power, strength, and glory. And wherever the children of men dwell, or the beasts of the field and the birds of the heaven, he has given them into your hand and has made you ruler over them all. You are this head of gold. So that even mentions the birds being subject to him and how God was empowering him. Now we turn to Daniel 5. And of course this is a story about Belshazzar, a later king. But he did not learn the lesson from what happened, of how God humbled Nebuchadnezzar. And he was full of pride and boasting. And so once again, Daniel is going to interpret these writing on the wall. So Daniel 5, beginning in verse 18. O king, the Most High God gave Nebuchadnezzar, your father, your forefather, our ancestor, a kingdom and majesty, glory and honor. And because of the majesty that he gave him, all peoples, nations, and languages trembled and feared before him. Whomever he wished, he executed. Whomever he wished, he kept alive. Whomever he wished, he set up. And whomever he wished, he put down. But when his heart was lifted up and his spirit was hardened in pride, he was deposed from his kingly throne, and they took his glory from him. So, isn't that amazing to put all those scriptures together as to the very unique and amazing way that God dealt with Nebuchadnezzar? Now, see, when he conquered Judah, who ended up being top advisors? Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So he had the influence of these people of God as well. So if he had learned his lesson even more deeply of respecting and honoring their religion, he would have had the opportunity with the power that he had if he had based everything on God's laws and continued to promote God's true religion. He could have brought wonderful, wonderful results to the whole world even more than he did. He did bring about stability and peace to a great extent. So it was a time of glory for the civilized world, but it did not bring paradise. It did not bring paradise. Because if human beings, so fallible, they're so prone to let things go to their head, so prone to have pride and think, I can do it and I don't really need God and His truth and so forth. Now, I'm not mentioning many great empires in the history of the world. I'm mentioning mostly empires that are mentioned a lot in the Bible, that are more significant as far as their relationship with God's plan and God's word. So next, I'm going to skip to another world-ruling empire. This one includes even Europe. And it's an empire that was very special in history because it was during this empire that the Messiah was born. The Messiah came to earth and was incarnated as a human being to live and to carry out a ministry and to start true Christianity for the earth. So this is the Roman Empire. And I'm here in Daniel. And I'm just going to go back to Daniel 2 and verse 40. And it says, and the fourth kingdom shall be as strong as iron, inasmuch as iron breaks in pieces and shatters everything. And like iron that crushes, that kingdom will break in pieces and crush all others. So this was foretelling the fact that the Roman Empire would be super powerful. A far-reaching empire. I'm just going to read what Wikipedia has to say to summarize the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire, which replaced the Roman Republic, began with Octavian's victory over Mark Antony in 27 BC. Then the size of the empire was dramatically increased, and it lasted approximately 500 years. It was the most powerful economic, cultural, political, and military force in the world of its time. The first two centuries of the empire's existence were a period of unprecedented political stability and prosperity, known as Pax Romana, or Pax Romana, which is Latin for Roman peace. But Pax Romana was not permanent. It did not bring paradise. You know, many historians have been quite fascinated by the rise and fall of the Roman Empire. How an empire could rapidly become so powerful, and then after a while, rapidly decline and collapse. And of course, historians see many, many parallels with what has happened and is happening and is likely to happen to the United States of America. So it's been fascinating to historians to try to figure out, well, how did they gain such power and then so quickly, and then how and why did it decline and fall as it did? Well, God probably had several reasons to enable that to happen. But of course, part of it was so that it would be a stable world into which the truth of God, the new covenant, could be instituted by Jesus Christ, and the church would be started, and there would be all these nice Roman roads that they could travel over, and it would be fairly safe as far as not a lot of crime and not a lot of instability. They could travel safely all over preaching the gospel. And also the Roman Empire, for a good while, gave complete freedom to the Christians. It was only later, much later, you know, like a couple of centuries later, that they began to look upon the Christians as a Jewish sect, another Jewish sect, and began to persecute them. But for a long time, there were certainly advantages for Christ ministry and the church. And, you know, with that availability of the knowledge of the Old Testament, and now with the writing of the New Testament, and with the stability in that Roman Empire, that could have been the launching pad for the truth of God to be spread all over the civilized world. So it was an empire that was obviously blessed of God in certain ways to enable all these things to happen. But it did not bring paradise. The next empire that I want to focus on was greatly blessed by God, and it would bring blessings to many, many parts of the earth. And that is Great Britain. Great Britain. Let's turn to Genesis 48 and read what it says there. Genesis 48. When Jacob, whose name was changed to Israel, was blessing his grandsons. And see just what was said and review this and be reminded of this very significant time. Remember that God began giving awesome promises to Abraham. And then they were repeated to Isaac and expanded, and repeated to Jacob and expanded, and repeated to Joseph and expanded. And now we come down to Genesis 48. Turned to the wrong chapter myself. Genesis 48, beginning in verse 14. Joseph has brought his sons in to their grandfather. And then it says, then Israel stretched out his right hand and laid it on Ephraim's head, who was the younger, and his left hand on Manasseh's head, guiding his hands knowingly, for Manasseh was the firstborn. And he blessed Joseph and said, God before whom my fathers Abraham and Isaac walked, the God who has fed me all my life long to this day, the angel who has redeemed me from all evil, bless the lads. Let my name be named upon them. And that means that in history and prophecy, the name Israel would be attached primarily to Joseph and to Joseph's descendants. And the name of my fathers, Abraham and Isaac, and let them grow into a multitude in the midst of the earth. Now when Joseph saw that his father had his right hand on the head of Ephraim, it displeased him, so he took hold of his father's hand to remove it from Ephraim's head to Manasseh's head. And Joseph said to his father, "Not so, my father, for this one is the firstborn. Put your right hand on his head." But his father refused and said, "I know, my son, I know. He also shall become a people, and he also shall be great. But truly his younger brother shall be greater than he, and his descendants shall become a multitude of nations." Now, because we're living in the 20th and 21st centuries, that seems somewhat surprising to us that in God's view, Great Britain was greater than the United States. But it depends on what you mean by great and what defines or makes up greatness. And if we had been living back in the late 1700s and especially the 1800s, we would have been awed by the British Empire. It did become a multitude of nations. The saying was, "The sun never sets on Britannica." Great Britain ruled the waves. It ruled the oceans. It colonized and governed many places, many countries around the world. The 1800s were considered the British century. I'm not going to turn to it, but in Genesis 49, we have Jacob's prophecy about how Joseph would be blessed. I mentioned Pax Romana. Well, now it was Pax Britannica. Pax Britannica. British peace over the world. In Deuteronomy 33, it mentions the 10,000s of Ephraim and the thousands of Manasseh. If you consider the people of the colonies, the numbers that were affiliated with Britain was far greater than the number that are now affiliated with the United States of America. There was a population explosion between 1750 and 1850. Even on the British islands, there was a population explosion. And then, of course, they began to migrate around the world and settle in other places and to establish colonies and to govern those colonies. Now, some of the people today have a hostile, negative attitude toward the history of Britain and the history of the United States. And it's like, oh, that Britain, it went around dominating people and taking over their countries and taking away their freedoms. Well, they don't really know true history, because the British knew they had such a good system and such good laws and good devotion to freedom and liberty and prosperity and stability and good relationships that they knew how to govern. They knew very well how to govern. And they regarded themselves as being benefactors to the world. They regarded the opportunity to go govern a nation as to bring stability and peace and prosperity to that nation, and certainly that's the way it was. Now, later on, colonies began to have groups within them that would rebel, and finally the British just kind of gave up and said, "Okay, well, I'll give you your independence." But in almost every case, the conditions in those countries have gone downhill. They're less prosperous, less stable, less happy, less freedom after the British pulled out. So God was using Britain in an amazing way for a long time. The British Empire became the largest and most beneficent empire in the history of the world. It had a quarter of the landmass of the earth and a quarter of its population. It had 5.5 times the territory of the Roman Empire, and more than four times the subjects of the Roman Empire. It strengthened and policed and united the world. It maintained peace and promoted prosperity. Their missionaries going around the world brought Bibles and taught biblical principles and distributed Bibles all over the world. And that greatly influenced the respect and use and reading of the Bible. And so that was a great start for spreading the truth of God. So a lot of good was accomplished. A lot of good that was accomplished. But again, a sad ending. A time came when Britain had gone down rapidly. And of course, part of that was what they suffered through World War I and World War II. They were so weakened and so decimated by the end of World War II that the United States kind of stepped into the vacuum then to become the leader of the world. But Britain did do a lot of good, and God gave them special opportunities. I mean, obviously, there had to be many miracles. How could a little island nation dominate most of the civilized world and bring about so much added peace and prosperity and stability to the world if it were not for God blessing them? Because these were largely the descendants of Ephraim. And God was fulfilling the promise that He had made from Abraham on down through Joseph and Ephraim. But again, it's fascinating to contemplate the rise and fall of the British Empire. The rise and the decline, the great decline of the British Empire. And now, of course, most Brits have no interest in the Bible, no respect for the Bible. The one more wonderful gift from God to the world, God's ultimate gift, you might say, a superpower nation founded mostly, originally, by Bible-believing people. Religious people who came with their Bibles, and even though they didn't understand it fully, they read it, they believed it, they respected it, they were trying to some extent to live by the Bible and to spread that knowledge to other peoples. And so the United States of America was the fulfillment of the promise to Manasseh. God filtered most of the Manassites through Europe, as well as Britain, and to migrate to America. And look at the physical blessings. You could say it was like a physical paradise, because we had the temperate climate, the fertile soil, the natural resources, the rivers, protected by oceans on both sides. And here it was easy to move in and take over. And so many amazing miracles took place for Manasseh to rapidly acquire all this land and to spread and develop the land and develop into a mighty nation. Remember, it was mostly settled by Bible-believing people. And so the United States became the most biblically-oriented nation ever in the world. The formation of the U.S. Constitution was greatly influenced by the founders' belief in the principles of the Bible. This system of government has provided the greatest personal freedom ever. This became the land of opportunity. It unleashed human creativity and resourcefulness, enabling anyone to be an entrepreneur. I was very inspired. I like to read history when I get a chance, and I was greatly inspired by the book, The 5,000-Year Leap. It's actually more of a 6,000, almost a 6,000-year leap. But anyway, that's the name of the book. Anybody else here have read that book, The 5,000-Year Leap? What this book does, it describes the phenomenal burst of energy and creativity and inventiveness and inventions and progress, industrial progress, technological progress, progress in every way you can imagine during the 1800s. Because you see, once the Americans won the Revolutionary War and things settled down and people started moving westward and were able to have land and complete freedom, almost complete freedom, they started inventing It's amazing the number of inventions. One of the things that is so interesting about this book, it specifically describes many, many of the inventions of the 1800s. Because people were always figuring out, well, how to do this and how to improve this. And there were such advancements. Most of the famous inventions of the Industrial Revolution were accomplished at that time. So what it's saying is that the world had gone for more than 5,000 years with virtually no progress in technology or machines and inventions. And it's like the world was held back, but then under this opportunity, all of a sudden, human beings with freedom and probably the blessings of God began to make such amazing progress. More than, you might say, more in one century than all the history of the world before that put together. And so the USA became the savior and policeman of the world to liberate people and to preserve their freedom. We would fight the tyrants of the world like the Nazis, liberate peoples, and then just give the land right back to them. When the United States has won its wars, it has not just stayed to claim that land for ourselves, but has been a wonderful to preserve and promote freedom around the world. And it's been the ideal country to serve as the base and headquarters for the end time work of God. Mr. Herbert Armstrong recognized that right away, that God had given us a unique opportunity with the prosperity and the literacy and the interest in the Bible and the desire to help other people and to share what we have with others, that this has become the ideal place, and it's continued to be right up to today, that this is obviously the best place for the end time work of God to be based and headquartered, is in this country. And so it's awesome how many Bibles are translated. I mean, how many languages we've translated the Bible into, and then how many Bibles are printed, and then how much they're sent all over the world, and largely from the United States, following the lead of the Brits. And we have done phenomenal work in spreading the Bibles all over the world. And then, of course, for the true Church of God. And I'm talking about both. I'm talking about the availability of Bibles, and then also the true Church of God being based here. So the United States has had the opportunity to be the shining city on the hill, a role model for the world. But you know, the name Manasseh means forgetting. And that's the problem. Manasseh has forgotten why she became great. And now Manasseh is in rapid decline. It's very sad to see. Of course, historians tell us that all democracies eventually commit financial suicide. And it usually happens between 200 and 250 years. They don't usually last very long. Because as soon as people realize, if I vote for certain people to be in office, they will turn around and give me gifts and entitlements and welfare and advantages that will help me financially. So I'm more concerned with what's going to help me instead of what's going to be good for the country. And so that's why democracies, even though we had a republic and a wonderful constitution, yet the weakness is the fact that being a democracy, democracies vote themselves into oblivion eventually. And so the United States is going downhill very rapidly. Well, that's not quite the end. God is going to allow and probably enable one more powerful world superpower to see what they will do. And that's the end time Babylon the Great, a.k.a. also known as the Beast. I'll turn to Revelation 13 and verse 1. The United States did not bring about paradise. did a lot of good things for a while, and we still are doing some good things. Revelation 13 and verse 1, "Then I stood on the sand of the sea, and I saw a beast rising out of the sea, having seven heads and ten horns, and on his horns ten crowns, and on his head heads a blasphemous name." I think the significance of saying it rises out of the sea is that you don't see it. It starts forming underground or under the sea. So for a long time, you don't really see it clearly. And then it just sort of suddenly appears as an organized power in the world. I'll turn to chapter 17 and verse 3. Chapter 17 and verse 3. "So he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness, and I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast, which was full of names and blasphemy, having seven heads and ten horns." So we see that the religious power and the civil and military power are going to cooperate and work together to be a very mighty power for a short time. To show you how powerful, look at chapter 18 and verse 3. Chapter 18 and verse 3. "For all the nations have drunk of the wine of the wrath of her fornication. The kings of the earth have committed fornication with her. And the merchants of the earth have become rich through the abundance of her luxury." And then verse 9, "The kings of the earth who committed fornication and lived luxuriously with her will weep and lament for her when they see the smoke of her burning, standing at a distance for fear of her torment, saying, 'Alas, alas, that great city Babylon, that mighty city, for in 1 hour your judgment has come.'" So for a short time, it is going to be very, very powerful. In fact, it's going to try to subjugate everybody and insist on everybody having the mark of the beast. And there's going to be tremendous pressure on Bible-believing people to not accept the mark of the beast. Because this is going to be an effort to unify the whole world under one power. And it will be awesome. And it will do a lot of good financially for many people. It is going to bring about great prosperity for many, many, many people. A very materialistic world it is going to be. But is it going to bring about paradise? No. For many reasons, it's not going to bring about paradise. So brethren, that set of special opportunities illustrates something very interesting about God's plan and how He has not only allowed human beings 6,000 years, but He has chosen various times in history to say, "Okay, I'm going to give you this advantage, and now I'm going to give you this opportunity, and see what difference that can make." Because otherwise, human beings would come up to the end of the age and say, "But God, if only you had given us time, and only if you'd given us this advantage, or if you'd given us this opportunity, we could have brought about paradise. We could have brought about utopia." But they're going to look back on history and realize, "Hey, you had every imaginable opportunity, and you blew it every time. You human beings blew it every time, and you could not bring about paradise." So I hope that you have learned your lesson. These great empires did some good. These peoples and these situations did some good. But usually in a limited area and for a limited time. And it was always mixed with evil. It was never pure righteousness on the earth, because evil was very quickly mixed in. Again, like Deuteronomy 29 verse 4 says, they did not have the heart. And so the Bible tells us that when Christ comes, He is going to give people a new heart and take away the heart of stone and give them the heart of flesh and offer His Spirit to them. So the good news is that Jesus Christ is going to return to earth, and He's going to establish the kingdom of God on the earth. And that 1,000 years is going to be the closest thing to paradise the world has ever known. I say the closest thing to paradise because it's not going to be quite paradise. As long as we have human beings, there can never be perfection. You might call it paradise light. It will be great. It will be a great life for the human beings on earth. Now, I did not try to save any time in this sermon to talk about the millennial conditions. I hope that you will be hearing a lot about that in the next couple of weeks, especially at the Feast of Tabernacles. But I'm showing you what has happened in the past and how the human beings have had all kinds of opportunities. And like Randall Bradford's sermon today, they did not keep on, people have not kept on the armor of God. They have not stuck to the nourishment, the food that God, spiritual food that God has offered. Man has not followed the instructions that God gave human beings. And so, the knowledge of God is going to spread over all the earth. And so with the knowledge of God and the offering of, basically, from what, if I understand it correctly, it's like immediately, or very quickly, God is going to call everybody. We speak of how somebody cannot understand the truth until he's called. You know, John 6:44, Jesus says, "No man can come to me except the Father draw him." Well, the doors are going to open up, and Christ is going to call and draw everyone. And so they're going to have the opportunity to not only have Bibles, but to really understand the Bible. And the opportunity to repent and to be baptized and receive God's Holy Spirit. And what a huge advantage when you have a world that eventually, practically everybody is going to be converted. Now, not everybody's going to be truly converted. It seems like some people are just going to conform and go along with it because that's the only way to explain how a great multitude is going to follow Satan the devil at the end of the millennium. Some people are going to appear to be converted, just like people we've known in the past we thought were converted. But most people, we believe, are going to become converted during that time. But because human beings are never perfect, there can never be true paradise as long as there are human beings. Human beings will still be able to make mistakes and commit sins even during the millennium. But there is going to be real paradise eventually, called the new heavens and the new earth, where only righteousness dwells and all the beings are spirit beings in the kingdom of God. I'm going to turn to 2 Peter 3. 2 Peter 3 and verse 13. Peter writes, "Nevertheless, we, according to his promise, look for not just the millennium, not just the return of Jesus Christ, but we look for new heavens and a new earth in which righteousness dwells." And then he reminds us of what we need to do in the next verse. "Therefore, beloved, looking forward to these things, be diligent to be found by him in peace, without spot and blameless." We wish we knew even more about what the new heavens and the new earth would be like, but of course, reading Revelation 21 and 22 gives us an awesome description there. Gives us a little glimpse of into what the world is going to be like at that time. There'll be no Satan and no demons around, no corrupt world and no corrupt influences, and no human beings with human nature. Brethren, at last the world will have paradise.